It's Tuesday, April 12th, 2018, and this is Comic Talk Today, or Thursday. That could only mean it's time for Therapy Thursday. And this week, I have two very special guests joining me, Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler, from a ton of books, all of which I'm reading, all of which I love. Of course, they did The Dregs for Black Mask, recently launched Coming to Me, also for Black Mask. They are the new runners on Cable. And of course, next week, they'll be launching her Infernal Descent from Aftershock Comics. So without further ado, here's my chat with Zach and Lonnie.
So I've heard some other people interview you guys, and the first question they always ask you is how you guys met, and that's boring. We're not going to do that. Because I think everyone knows the story by now. But what I found interesting was that I believe, Lonnie, you said in an interview that both your moms are named Lynn. Now, when you guys met and when you found this out, did you guys have a Batman vs. Superman moment?
That came later.
It was just like the movie.
It was.
Yeah, Zach had his foot on my throat and was about to kill me. And I was like, not Lynn! And he was like, why did you say that name?
That's awesome.
I think I don't even know. Was the book already solidified as a pitch before we realized that both of our moms had shared the first name?
Yeah, I think it was at some point like during the inception of the idea, and we were like, what? How did we not know that after knowing each other for this long?
Yeah, it seemed like we kind of collectively blew it, and so we leaned into that as much as we could.
That's awesome. How'd you guys like that movie, by the way?
Batman v Superman?
Yeah.
If I never have to see it again,
Yeah, there's actually a circle in hell in her Infernal Descent where people are just made to watch it over and over again.
Oh man, I must be in that circle. I've seen that like five times.
I know. Oh, man.
I know.
How do you do that to yourself?
I must have disposable income, I guess. I don't know. I went to see it in theaters three times, actually. With my kids. Wow. Yeah, with my kids.
Did your kids like it?
Yeah, they liked it. They really liked it.
I'm sure they must have.
Yeah, I try to take them to as many as I can, because my wife has this thing against comic books. My wife hates comic books, which is a problem because I read a ton of comic books. But it happens. Matter of fact, the only comic book movie she's seen is Deadpool, and she didn't even know it was a comic book. So she just loves Ryan Reynolds. She's like, let's go see this movie, and I was like, all right, cool. And we start watching it, and like 10 minutes in, she's like, wait, this is a comic book movie, isn't it? And I was like, yep, it sure is.
just coyly play and naive.
Yeah. It works. Yeah, it worked out. That's the only way I can do it, man. She wouldn't even see Wonder Woman or anything. She just doesn't care.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad. So, I want to get right into. I know you guys are doing Cable. We'll talk about that briefly. I'm more interested in the indie guy stuff that you guys are doing. So coming to me, my question for you on that is: I know you guys share a Google Doc. You guys write your stories kind of in tandem. How much of the way that you guys work inspired what happens in Coming to Me? Because when I heard that, I thought it was pretty interesting that you guys are kind of working like sort of with this weird connection. You maybe fight for control a little bit, but ultimately the best idea wins.
Yeah, it's actually weird. It's sort of like, I think it's this subtextual thing, this unconscious thing that Zach and I never even considered that until like after the first issue came out. And we'd been developing this concept for like 4 years at this point, and someone brought it up at some point. They were like, you guys are like kind of using this technology. And I guess it never really clicked until somebody else told us. But yeah, maybe it's our way of like, our unconscious is like dealing with, you know, the frustrations of writing with each other by like putting it all into this book or something.
That's fair. I know that you guys had originally pitched that, or you guys were working on that as your first book together, but you guys had The Dregs come out first. Why did you guys choose to do that over Coming to Me?
Oh, we were aggressively trying to get both made at the same time, and there was a point at which Come Into Me and The Dregs were both, like, it was, Come Into Me was almost greenlit at a different company, and we were going to actually write both of them at the same time, and thank God we didn't, because it would have consumed both of us, and we probably would have died in the process. But I think it was more just a matter of right place, right time with The Dregs, rather than we had both of the pitches ready to go, and we just sent The Dregs to Black Mass because we thought The Dregs would be more in line with the ideals of the publisher in terms of dealing with gentrification and homelessness and that kind of thing. And then later, after we learned how to make a Black Mass book, we kind of took the things that were already there in the pitch for Come Into Me and elevated them to a point where they're starting to make a social commentary. And I'm really happy it went the way that it did, because honestly, if we tackled Come Into Me as our first book together, it would have
sucked.
Yeah, it would have been a nightmare.
Well, when you guys pitch the books, how far in do you get? Like, are you writing a full issue? Or are you, like, you kind of have an idea of where you want to go? How is the process work for you guys?
I think at first, Zach and I would put, like, a lot into our pitches. You know, we'd plan out as much as we possibly could. But I think we're at a point now where we've pitched so many books and so many of them have been rejected that we don't want to set ourselves up for disappointment. And an easy way to set yourself up for disappointment is to plan a whole story that you then fall in love with that then nobody wants to publish. So we try not to get down to, like, the nitty-gritty details until, like, it's actually greenlit. But obviously publishers want to see a lot up front. So we try to, like, outline the basic beats and solidify the themes and the characters and stuff like that first. But there's no, like, strict regimented outlining until the book is, like, 100% go.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. We were pretty naive, I think, both Come Into Me and The Dregs as well, in that, like, we kind of developed them to a point where they were fully fleshed out, and, like, we knew the meat of every issue for both of those books, and they were literally the only two pitches we had for, like, 2 years, and luckily got picked up, but, like, we know that that's not usually the story of, like, indie comic book writing. Like, we are the exception to the rule, not the rule.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. I mean, we've been rejected a lot, but we've also been very fortunate at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, I think one thing that I noticed is that Black Mask really, it seems to make a concerted effort to try new types of stories. Which, I mean, I guess most indie publishers would want to do that. But I've definitely seen that there, especially with a lot of socio-political commentary in particular. And, you know, the same kind of goes for Aftershock as well. Because they don't really have, like, the typical superhero or typical comics type stories. They do try many different things.
Yeah, I think Black Mask at the moment is very unique in the sense that they're, a decent-sized publisher. And they're one of the only ones who's willing to take risks on nobodies, as Zach and I were about a year ago at this time. And even companies who are, you know, indie companies like Image, you see less and less that they're taking risks on people who have never put out a book anywhere before.
Yeah.
And Aftershock seems like they're starting to go down that path. You know, they took risks with us when we'd only put out one book. We'd only put out The Dregs when they started talking to us. So I think they're realizing the power of the new young people that are coming into comics and how they have a distinct voice from people who have been in the industry for years already.
Yeah, that's something that I talked to Joe at C2E2 last year. Because since they started, they always wanted to try to get big names to do books over there, in particular writers, and pair them up with an artist that would make sense. And I'm noticing now more and more, you know, with Donnie coming in and then you guys, they're really taking a chance on newer talent, and I find that really refreshing. Because, like, it's awesome to see, like, you know, Warren Ellis or Grant Morrison or, you know, whatever, Garth Ennis doing stuff. But to see the new talent, the fresh blood of people that are, like, roughly my age or younger, bring in the love of comics that they had and try to make their own thing out of whatever they grew up with is more interesting to me, right? Because you're getting new stuff. getting exciting stuff that wasn't tried before. And I think that's overall interesting in comics, I would say, at least on the indie side, is that does seem to be, I guess publishers want to try new and different things. Hell, maybe like DC and Marvel are doing that to some extent as well. But it's just nice to see, you know, a lot of people are kind of worried about the economy of the comic industry, but I think at least creatively, it's just really interesting. And like, you guys are over at Marvel now, Rosenberg's over there, Donny Cates. And I mean, you guys are guys coming in from the indie side, now working on these big franchise properties, and you can take risk with what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of it is tricking them into taking risks, I think. Because we've had to do a little bit of a delicate dance in that, like, it's really exciting to work on properties, but there's a lot at stake, right? I mean, like, Cable's an action figure, and he's going to be in a movie, and there's a lot there that rides on, we can't have him doing crazy shit that's just out of character for him. And I think, like, we experienced that in a really interesting way where our first Cable arc that got green lit and put into production was like a hard-boiled detective story, like, set in all kinds of different timelines. And at some point, someone somewhere down the line was like, wait a second, this guy's going to be in a fucking movie this summer.
Yeah.
And he can't be solving a murder during the Byzantine Empire. It just isn't going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a wake-up call.
But to go back to one of your points, because I wanted to mention something about, like, Aftershock pursuing, like, new talent and new creators. One of the most interesting things for me, and I think Lonnie experienced something similar, is we sat down shortly after we made a deal with Aftershock with Mike Martz, who's the editor-in-chief there. And we were talking to him about some of the X-Men stories that we loved and some of the stuff that we grew up on. And, you know, we didn't know, but, like, Mike was the editor on all of that
stuff.
Right, yeah. And so it's this weird meeting of generations in which this guy who helped craft some of our favorite stories at the Big Two is now helping us craft our indie books. And so we've learned so much in that process and had this really interesting discussion and conversation creatively that, you know, we never would have been able to learn from someone like him if he didn't take a chance. And it's been fantastic.
So what's the difference in terms of, like, editorial for you guys working at Black Mask or Aftershock over Marvel? Because, from what I saw in Cable 155, it seems like they let you guys do almost kind of whatever you wanted. It wasn't a typical Cable story, let's say that.
Yeah,
we're allowed to use less 9-panel grids at Marvel, and we have to say every character's name several times in each issue.
Huh.
They're
very concerned about just making sure that if this is somebody's first comic book, that they can understand the basics of it without having to go through back issues or read things online. And so that's what Marvel's about. You know, they want to be as inclusive as possible. And I think that's something that I respect that a lot about them, but it was definitely a learning curve for Zach and I when we first started working there.
Yeah. I mean, like, conversely, like, Black Mask has no editorial oversight whatsoever. Like, we are responsible for, and, like, Matt Pizzolo, who runs the company, is amazing, and we owe him our career entirely, but he entrusts us to deliver a finished product on the day that we go to the printer. So, like, he won't read our scripts, he won't be involved with getting the art together or anything like that. Like, we literally do from, you know, step one to step 100, all the way through, and then he'll read the issue right before it goes to press and be like, hey, I have some thoughts, and we'll be like, too late.
That's got to be kind of nice, though, right? Being allowed that much freedom to do what you want to do.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It spoiled us to have that this early in our careers.
Exactly, yeah, because I mean that's why the dregs exist. Like I think you've read the dregs, correct, Marvin?
Oh yeah, of course.
Okay, so like we didn't really tell anyone about the fact that like the last 10 pages of the last issue were going to be in black and white. We just kind of just did it and then like delivered it to Black Mask. And it was the type of thing that we're just like, well, they don't know this is coming, but we're not even sure if they'll care. And it's we knew that from the get-go that we were going to do something crazy like that. But it's like, I don't know. That would be a discussion at every other publisher. With Black Mask, he just emailed us and he was like, hey, are these supposed to be in black and white? And we're like, yeah. And he's like, okay, dope. And I'm like, that was it.
And I think part of that, though, part of having that freedom is like the reason we were able to get someone like Eric Savodsky, who's been drawing comics for the better part of 10 years, to be on that book with us, because he knew, regardless of anything else that happened with the book, that he was free to experiment and to do whatever he wanted. And having that sense of openness at a publisher is really amazing and really conducive for people trying new things. And that's how you get good books, in my opinion.
Yeah, doing their best work, right? Because you're just like, I think a lot of the dregs was an experiment of like, well, this could be a huge disaster, but at least we're throwing everything we've got into it. So, you know, and then it worked out.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. All right, so let's talk about Cable a little bit. I'm going to tell you guys, I'm not the biggest Marvel fan, but one thing that I've always enjoyed is the X-Men side of the universe, and Cable in particular. Now, I know you guys have your personal favorite X-Men. Why don't you guys tell me what those are, by the way, and I'll tell you why you're wrong.
Zach, you can start.
Well, my favorite all-time X-Man is Phantom X.
Good choice.
I don't know, the Morrison new X-Men run is some of my favorite stuff, and I really fell in love with Phantom X over the Uncanny X-Force run, so he would be my top. I really love Bishop, and I really love Beast as well. I think both of those characters are really, really interesting. And Cable was up there for me even before we started writing him, but now I absolutely adore that character. And Lonnie, I know your answer.
Yeah, mine's also multi-tiered. It's I'm a big fan of Magic, Kitty Pryde, X-Man, and Nightcrawler.
All right, so you have one right answer there, because I think Magic is number three for me. So my top three would be Emma Frost, Blink, and Magic.
Nice.
Yeah, Blink is very underutilized.
Extremely underutilized. And I know she's in that new Exiles book, which I haven't read yet, but I'm excited to check that out.
I also love Warlock. I love Warlock from the New Mutants era with Claremont and Sienkiewicz.
Now, that's another one that's really underutilized, too.
Yes.
Maybe not for long.
Oh. I like that.
Well, still underutilized.
Oh, no, that's fair enough. All right, let's talk about her Infernal Descent. I have so many questions, and I hate to go as deep as I want to go into this book, because the book's not even out yet. It comes out next week. But I read this book about 3 or 4 times, and every time I read it, I picked something new up. And I'm going to leave my biggest question for the end, because you probably will not answer it. okay. But when I went to college, I was an English major, so I'm picking up a lot of literary references, and some that aren't even stated. They're just kind of hidden off on the side of a panel. So I want to kick things off with, why William Blake? Why is he the one that's guiding Lynn through this journey?
I went to... my undergrad, my degree is in philosophy and English lit, and I had a particular affinity for William Blake, and not just his poetry, but also his paintings, his watercolors, and stuff. And he had himself a very strong affinity for Dante's work and for the Divine Comedy, and it just sort of made sense that we wanted somebody to be a guide to the main character Lynn in the book, and we wanted it to be someone from literary history, and somebody who made sense in that world to be in this retelling of Dante's Inferno, and somebody who would know that world intimately. So it just sort of kind of naturally fit. He was one of the first people we thought of. And from there, we were like, oh, well, he should talk in verse, you know. And we started reading more and more about his life, and everything just meshed together perfectly.
Is that hard for you guys to do, to write in verse that way?
I love it. Zach's not as fond of it.
Yeah. I mean, like, I enjoy it to a degree. It's just that, like, you know, matching tenses and stuff, it's always, it requires you to be very inventive, which is awesome and so much fun. But sometimes you're just like, fuck, like, what are we going to rhyme with this fucking word?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, but it kind of makes sense in the way that it's doing it, I suppose. You guys picked a couple of particular works of William Blake's to be in this first issue. And my main question for you guys, and maybe this will be explained, but I'm assuming that Charon is kind of a minor character in the story overall. What is it about choosing On Another Sorrow to be such a driving moment in this first issue, with allowing Lynn and William Blake to get on Charon's boat and head over to hell? What was it that, I guess, impacted Charon so much that allowed them to get on the boat? Because he was pretty adamant about not letting her get on there, because she's still alive.
Yeah, there's translations of the Inferno that speak to the word of power being like verse, and that when the demons of hell hear very powerful verse, they kind of bend their will. And so we wanted to take something that spoke to William Blake's long history of writing poetry and do something that was really fucking weird and get him to recite his own work to Charon and get him to kind of break his resolve and shed a tear of fire.
Yeah, and the lines we picked in particular, we felt that they related strongly to Lynn's journey over the course of the five issues that you'll see. You know, if you read into it, once you sort of get through the next few issues and you realize why Lynn is there and why her family is there, it sort of comes to have more meaning.
Well, that's kind of going to be my last question, so we'll save that part. you guys did pick many famous historical figures to be in this book, just like in Dante's Inferno. Matter of fact, I still got the first copy of Inferno that I purchased, and I don't know if you guys have ever seen, there's a version that's got English on one side and the original Italian on the other.
Yeah.
And it's awesome to read that way. My Italian's very, it's not very good. It's not. My dad's side of the family is Sicilian, so you figured I would maybe know Italian, but I don't. I took a year of college, and that's about it. And the only reason I took Italian was not because of my family history, was because of Dante's Inferno. Maybe I could get somewhat of an understanding of what I was reading. But you guys picked a lot of famous figures on here, and were those specific choices made to advance the story, or are you guys trying to say something about the journey that Lynn is on with each of these characters?
It's a bit of both.
Yeah. I think we picked a lot of people that we had a particular affinity for, but also people that would be able to speak to what she's going through emotionally in the issue. And, like, I don't know what copy of the book that you had, but each issue of the book deals with the five stages of grief. So the first one being denial. And so we tried to use characters that also represent that emotional state.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the Inferno, Dante populated it with a lot of people from, you know, culture, pop culture at his time. And we wanted to do that in a way that was updating it and bringing in new pop culture figures from, across, you know, the last hundreds of years, and to have characters that made sense for the levels that we were putting them in, who would be, you know, punished or or judged and sentenced to those areas. But yeah, could also, a lot of them, we wanted these to be figures, a lot of the time that Lin would recognize, because, you know, when Dante is going through the Inferno, he recognizes all these people and has something to say about it, or they have something to say to him. And we wanted to try to replicate that, but for a modern era.
Nice, I like that. Yeah, I noticed when those characters were being brought in, I started to see some similarities between maybe what you guys are trying to say in this book and what you guys are maybe hinting at in Coming to Me. And I know both are still first issues, so there's a lot of story yet to be told. but the fact that these philosophers and musicians and writers and everything are kind of like, they probably asked 3 or 4 times at different points in the story whether they're still remembered in the real world. Like, do people still care about them? Do they still read their works? And I kind of got some of that also in Coming to Me. I can't remember the main character's name, the lady, but, you know, she wants to be in on this experiment and offers to pay in to partake of it, to share in these other experiences. And I found that really fascinating because I've talked to a few friends of mine who've read Coming to Me. They haven't read Her Infernal Descent yet. And they've read some of your other works, The Dregs in particular. And, you know, they talked a lot about how there's some themes that are similar, but overall the stories feel so different. But for me, like, reading all these, and even Cable to some extent, because I think there are some similarities with the way that you guys are treating the family relationship between Cable and Hope, where there's a lot of, like, subtext that really runs across everything you guys do. And to me, it makes it a lot more cohesive and more interesting and more personable. Have you guys had similar experiences from other people reading your works where they're kind of relating on that kind of personal level?
Yeah, for some people, I think that are able to. I mean, not everyone is as kind as you and reads our books multiple times. Most people just like read it and like throw it beside the toilet. But for us, it's sort of a matter of, we did The Dregs. Zach and I both really love that book. We're very proud of it, and we knew Coming to Me would be our second book, and we knew Her Infernal Descent would be our third book, and we knew that we wanted to make books that were different so that we didn't get pigeonholed into something as like, oh, those are the crime guys, or, oh, those are the guys who write only body horror, or those are the guys who only write literary stuff. And so it was a conscious effort on our part to sort of make these three stories distinct enough that they don't feel like you're getting the same story just over and over again. But obviously, Zach and I, you know, we have an affinity for particular themes, and we talk about a lot of the same things sort of over and over again. And there's that old adage that every storyteller, every artist is basically telling the same story over and over and over again. So I think you're right to say that there's, you know, things that are repetitive or things that carry through each of our series, and I think there always will be.
Yeah, and I think some of that was even realized, like, after the fact, where we're just like, oh, shit, we're dealing with this again. and like, in a really interesting way, because we're approaching it from a completely different angle, but it sort of evokes similar themes. And like Lonnie said, it was very much a concerted effort on our behalf to make sure that we don't get put into a box.
Sure.
And we really love genre. And so we've been just leaning into genre. So our next projects are, again, stepping really far away from what we've already done.
But also very similar.
Yeah.
Well, you want that familiarity, right? That's how you keep people coming back.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a matter of, it's always going to be us, right?
Yeah.
We're never going to change as people to the extent that we're going to be exploring something that's like, that doesn't make sense to us, right? So yeah, these ideals of like, you know, family and things like memory and legacy are always things that Zach and I are talking about, and for better or worse, end up in our pitches more often than not.
Like, every book we're writing is about memory.
Yeah, it's like we'll start concepting something, and then like an hour later, we'll be like, "Oh yeah, and it's about memory," and then we're like, "God damn it,
here we are again."
No, that's important though, because so there's people that they'll start whining about when a particular type of writer does a certain character, right? Like, there's people that complain because there's like a man writing a female character, or, you know, a white male writing a black female character. And I get the need for diversity. But my point is, you know, what, if you have a good writer, there's nothing saying that that person can't write something in the point of view of a different person, right? Like, if you understand people well enough, that makes you a good writer, and that allows you empathy, to right? branch beyond. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you got to take empathy for your character, and like, and it's I understand exactly what you're talking about, you know, making hiring people who are the right people to tell those stories, especially if they're particularly vested in that point of view. But I think the flip of that is that your job as a writer is to do the proper research and embed yourself within the narrative to a point where you have empathy for that character's point of view and that struggle, and that you can tell it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think, you know, it goes back to, if people were only ever allowed to write exactly what they were, the entire fantasy genre or science fiction genres wouldn't exist.
Right.
And even more to that point, you have Shakespeare, who some of his best plays involve women or people gender bending, or something like Othello, where it was obviously he wasn't a black man, but because he's able to empathize and put himself in those shoes and try to understand it, he's able to create some of the greatest characters of all time. So I just think the argument that you shouldn't write things outside of what you know is like, I don't know, I think it's pretty weak.
Well, it's I think also unfair, not just to the reader, but to the writer, right? Because as a writer, I'm sure you guys don't want to write the same thing over and over again, right? Just because you know it'll sell to somebody.
Of course, and I think it's, you know, because of the political climate we're in, I think it's important when people try to write outside of who they are. It's just a matter of doing the research and trying to make sure that it's authentic and talking to people from those communities in which you're writing characters in, to, you know, just to make sure you're informed. But you have to do the work, but I think it's important for people to be allies to different communities and for that to show in their writing.
All right, so in Her Infernal Descent, you guys made some interesting choices with the panel layouts. And I think aside from like a page or two that were full page spreads, not a full page spread, whatever, you know what I mean. Most of the book was either, if I'm not mistaken, 5 panels or 9 panels. Is that right?
That's right. Correct.
All right. So what I'm assuming, I have an idea on the 9. I'm not quite sure on the 5. I have an idea on the 5, but not quite sure. So the 9 must be because it's the 9 circles of hell.
Yes.
What about the 5?
The 5 is multi-tiered. We chose 5 as an early motif in the book. Early on in the book, we chose 5 as a motif. There's, you know, the 5 stages of grief. There's 5 members of Lynn's family. There are, she wears like a hamsa that has 5 fingers on it. And there's all these images of 5 that keep coming up. And I think it's both to remind readers of what she's going through and to, to sort of represent her struggle, right? She's always thinking of these 5 things, right? So it's just all about trying to recreate her experience by making the form of the book match the content.
And it was a lot for us to take an experiment and say, like, okay, we're going to work within confines, and how do we experiment within this box, right? The storytelling box. And, you know, we reached out to Kyle very early on, and we're like, this is what we're thinking. Are we fucking crazy? And he was like, no, I love that. And so that's been really interesting in terms of, like, now when we go to lay out an issue, we're like, okay, this is a 9, this is a 5, this is a 9, this is a 5, and here's why. And there's always a good reason for why each page fits within that layout that it does. And so it makes us really we're always very carefully considering every panel and why it matters, but even more so in this book.
Yeah, I had a question about the Hamza, but maybe you kind of answered it. Because I didn't even catch it on my first read. The second time I read the book, I noticed the Hamza on her shoulder that she was wearing. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. I was like, maybe that's part of the reason she's not... I mean, there's multiple reasons, right? Her family is gone. And so I think, at least for me, she seems very disjointed from reality. Like, when William Blake's ghost shows up, she's kind of like, yeah, okay, you're a ghost, whatever. But she has no fear throughout this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting to have the Hamza there, because that's a symbol of protection, right? And
yeah.
I don't know if she wears that on purpose or if it's just like a nice thing that she bought at a thrift shop or something, but, I thought that was a nice touch. And, there's a lot of things like that in this book. And this leads to kind of my big question. And if this spoils future issues of the story, by all means, don't answer. But as I was reading, I got this weird vibe from Lynn. And when I reread it, I noticed a couple of books kind of hidden off to the side. Agatha Christie books. I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to give titles because if people go look them up, I don't want it to be like, oh. How important will that be to future issues of Lynn's story?
You will get the answer in the next issue.
Oh, wow. That's quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I wasn't expecting it that quick. Okay. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. She, I'll just say that obviously Lynn has she loves Agatha Christie. Yeah, there's some interesting things that happen with her love for Agatha.
Awesome. All right. So every time I have a guest on the show, I do a little trivia game. So we're going to do a little quick trivia game, and then we'll wrap up.
Oh, no. Let's make sure you're real anxious.
Now, because there's two of you, I have decided to give you guys a choice of which game we're going to play. So the first one is Fly Into Me. It's a Cronenberg trivia. And then we've got Cable Guy, which, of course, is the cable trivia game. So I'll let you guys decide which ones you guys want to do.
I would much rather do a Cronenberg.
All right.
Why not? Let's do Cronenberg.
All right. So I'm gonna read up the questions, and then these are all multiple choice. So I'll give you the question, and then I'll give you the choices, and you guys can figure out however you want to choose an answer.
All right.
Okay. If you're right, you'll hear the bell ring. All right. So question number one. The tagline of which Cronenberg film is "the only thing worse than losing your mind is finding it again"?
Oh, fuck. Ah, shit.
All right, I'm going to give you some choices.
Okay.
A, Scanners. B, Stereo. C, Shivers. Or D, Spiders.
I would say Spider.
I'm going to say Scanners.
All right. The correct answer is Spiders.
Oh.
All right. Go on to the next one. I'm only going to count if one of you guys chooses the right answer, I'll count that as a correct answer. How about that?
All right.
Debbie Harry starred in which of these Cronenberg films? Crash, Videodrome, Existenz. By the way, Existenz is my favorite thing ever. When I was reading Coming to Me, I was like, holy shit, this is Existenz in a comic book. And The Brood.
That's Videodrome.
Videodrome.
Videodrome is correct. Man, you guys are good. All right. Jeremy Irons plays a man falling in love with another man unknowingly, believing he's a Chinese woman in which film? Dead Ringers, Spiders, The Dead Zone, or M. Butterfly?
Dead Ringers.
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. Jeremy Irons plays a man falling in love with another man unknowingly, he's a Chinese woman in which film? Dead Ringers,
That's Spiders.
M. Butterfly.
I feel like a fucking idiot.
M. Butterfly is correct.
Yeah, Zach, you threw me off with that one because I was like, damn it, did I not hear the question properly? Like, he was so confident.
I heard Jeremy Irons and I was like, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's man. Which film is based on a William S. Burroughs novel? Existenz, The Fly, The Dead Zone, or Naked Lunch?
Naked Lunch.
Naked Lunch is correct. Which movie matches with the tagline saying, be afraid? be very afraid. The Brood, Dead Ringers, The Fly, or Rabid?
The Fly.
I believe it's The Brood.
The correct answer is The Fly.
Damn it.
All right, you guys are doing good.
I remember that on the poster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Does David Cronenberg himself play the gynecologist in The Fly, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Yes is... Johnny Smith is a character in which of these movies? The Dead Zone, Spiders, Scanners, or Naked Lunch?
Johnny Smith?
Johnny Smith.
Oh, man. It's the worst name ever.
I think it's The Dead Zone.
Oh, yeah, that's the main character's name. Yeah.
Yeah, Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken, yeah.
Johnny Smith.
You guys are on a roll. All right. David Cronenberg was set to direct which of the following movies? The Terminator, Total Recall, The Thing, or Darkman?
Total Recall.
Total Recall.
That is... Golly.
His script exists for it, too, out there, and it's really good. Yeah.
Really?
It's really good. He created the mutants in that movie.
No kidding.
It's all him. Yeah.
That makes sense. The tagline, "Love in the dying moments of the 20th century," belongs to which movie? This one's a fill-in-the-blank. The tagline, "Love in the dying moments of the 20th century," belongs to which movie? This is one of the more recent ones.
Yeah, I know which one it is. I just don't remember the title. It's the one with Freud and...
Oh, A Dangerous Method.
Yeah, that's it.
The correct answer is Crash.
Oh, what?
Really?
Oh, yes.
Damn, okay.
Yeah, you know, they go and crash cars on purpose to, you know... Do the damn thing.
Damn it.
All right. Which film starred Jennifer Jason Leigh? Dead Ringers, Existence, Spiders,
Existence.
Or Crash?
Existence.
Existence is correct. Let's see how you guys did. Doing my tally here. 8 out of 10. That's pretty damn good, guys. I will say that you guys really are Cronenberg fans.
Yeah, it should have been 10 out of 10. I feel embarrassed for myself.
Just blame it on Zach. It's fine.
Yeah, it's your fault, Zach.
I'm well aware.
If we ever meet Cronenberg, I'm going to tell him it was your fault.
All right.
That'd be awesome. All right, let's wrap this up. I know Relay's coming up, what, next month, right?
Relay has the free comic book day issue. Hits first Saturday in May, and then issue one hits in July, but I don't know what date in July yet because solicits haven't been released yet.
Gotcha. I'm excited for that.
I read the Zero issue from Free Comic Book Day, and it is dope.
Yeah?
It sounds dope. Is very good.
I'll actually send it to you, Martin.
Yeah, send it to me. Why not? I'll take a look.
It's free.
Oh, can't beat free. Anything else that you guys want to tease might be coming up? Or are you guys just too busy writing 300 books right now?
We have some cool stuff coming out. Nothing we can really talk about yet, but... There's more coming from us.
We literally just got a green light on our longest series ever today. So
no kidding.
Yeah, we're gonna start getting to work.
Yeah, we're gonna just go home and cry for a bit, and then
yeah, exactly.
All right, so before we wrap up, if you guys had to choose one character to write a book on, any character from any publisher, who would you choose? I don't need to why, just who would you choose?
Swamp Thing.
Yeah, I'll just not say Swamp Thing and go with Animal Man.
Oh, dude, that'd be awesome if you guys did one doing Animal Man, one doing Swamp Thing.
And then connect
them.
Holy crap. Die.
Yeah, it'd be the dream.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. All right, why don't you guys tell everybody where they can find you, and then we'll head on out.
You can find me in a dark hole somewhere.
It's the best place.
Also on Twitter, at @lawn_monster.
You can find me in any Salvation Army parking lot. And I'm on Twitter at @ZachBEThompson.
And of course you can find me at GeekMind. The show is everywhere. Just search for Comic Talk Today and you'll find it. And now on iHeartRadio somehow. I haven't decided how. But thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow.